Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's episode of What the Health Just Happened, where we talk about all things healthcare, community, business, and life. The goods, the bads, the ups, the downs, the lefts, the rights, and everything in between. We are so fortunate to have on a variety of guests way smarter than we are to share their business and life expertise. Today is no different. I'm excited. Maybe it'll get emotional. Maybe it won't. I'm sure we'll laugh some as well. But we have, this is what I wrote down for you. TEDx speaker, right? Entrepreneur, founder and CEO of Sophros Recovery and Guy in Recovery, Nick Padlow.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Welcome to Thunderdome. I don't know if that's true. Welcome to What the Hell Just Happened. We've talked on and off for months. The Guy in Recovery thing, I pulled that from LinkedIn. We'll get to that in a second. But let's start off. Sophros.
Yeah, that's fine.
I just said it right twice. What's the theory? Well, first, what is the business? What are you guys doing? Because I think it's pretty cool. This is something I can relate to. But what is the business? What do y'all do?
So when people go to treatment for addiction, we often think about like detox or residential treatment. You go off to rehab.
Yep.
But unfortunately for most of us, that doesn't work on its own. Like we have to do something afterwards. And so Sophros operates in two places. One is PHP and IOP. So that's just fancy for partial hospitalization and intensive outpatient. And all that means is our clients are with us anywhere from 3 to 6 hours a day, really working on the tools and skills to be successful in recovery.
You're one of the first guests ever that said an acronym and then told us what the acronym meant.
Yes, thank you. I was going to say thank you.
So let's rewind a little bit. Yeah. In recovery from addiction, which can be a variety of things. Inpatient, you're staying under a roof. You're there 24 hours a day. Outpatient, that's what you said. IOP, which stands for?
Intensive outpatient.
And that consists of how many hours a day, how many days a week?
3 hours a day, four-ish days a week.
And then PHP stands for?
Partial hospitalization. And all that means is you're with us 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. So it's like a full, I always say it's kind of like either a full-time job or a part-time job.
Yeah.
You still live at home or you still live at sober living or whatever, but you're with us a significant amount of time. Because what we found is like, you know, when people say, oh, I'm not ready to go to residential. I don't want to go to residential for this reason, X, Y, and Z. You know, my kids, my dog, my work, whatever it might be. But yet going to see your therapist once a week is like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet hole.
It's not enough.
And so, you know, you feel good after that hour. And then between that hour and the next week, you start to dip back down again.
Yeah.
And then you're just getting back to where you were. And it's this kind of bobbing motion where you're like never getting a breath.
Do you see a therapist?
On and off. Right now I'm not, but I will probably in the next, you know, couple months go back for a little bit.
Time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm very similar. I'm a huge advocate of seeing therapy. But I'll go consistently and feel great and leave a therapist like, yeah, I'm invincible. And then as that week goes on, day by day, I'm like, all right, I need to fill that bucket back up.
And I did say I'm not seeing a therapist right now, but I also have like my coach who's kind of my, you know, spiritual Buddhist therapist guy. And then I've also got a sponsor I see twice a week. And then, you know, I also go to me. So I still do a lot.
You've got plenty of free therapists. That's what I call for it, sure. Right? Instead of paying, what is it now, $200 an hour? It's probably it's 220 actually. It's crazy. Anyways, let's talk about that. So the recovery space, this is impossible to answer, but when should someone seek recovery, whatever that looks like?
As soon as either you or someone you love starts to say, I think you might have a problem.
That moment.
Go
ahead.
No, I was just going to say like, you know, we often say people that don't have a problem don't get asked that question. Like
That's a great point.
If you're like having two glasses of wine with dinner and you leave the second one half full and you walk away, no one's like, hey, do you think you might be drinking too much? Like that question's not asked. Right. And so we have two choices. One, we can just let that go to its natural progression, which is going to end us up, you know, losing a whole lot of important things in our life and ending up in treatment, or we can start doing something about it. And I'm not saying everybody that has ever been asked that question needs to go to residential treatment, but we need to be doing something unless we want it to go there.
That's a great perspective, which I never thought about. Because the answer is different for everyone, what level of support they need. So can you share your journey? Like this man went to West Point, incredible, right? Incredible, would you call it a college? What would you call West Point?
Institution.
It's a prison, yeah.
Well, so just a small segue. So there was, I remember I was sitting in a West Point classroom and I was in like psychology class or something. And we were learning about this concept of a total institution. And it said, this is not a West Point textbook. It was just a generic textbook. And it said something like, a total institution is a place where every aspect of your life is controlled. Examples of total institution include insane asylums, maximum security prisons, and military academies like West Point.
This is while you're in school.
I'm looking around like, well, that's where I am today.
Did anyone else in the class catch that? Or were you looking around?
No,
like,
it definitely came up.
Oh,
for sure.
In the papers. Yeah. So West Point, what did you study there?
Law, undergrad law.
Did you want to be a lawyer?
I thought I did at the time. Yeah, I was going to go be a JAG lawyer, but ended up not.
I'm trying to. This is a very intelligent individual. Then you got your master's from Stanford.
Yeah,
and then you went and turned into the entrepreneurial world. Talk about that. Kind of the transition to then recovery and software.
Yeah. So one of the things I actually had a small segue at a company called Bain and Company doing strategy consulting after. So it's kind of like I had a 5-year MBA education, so to speak, where I was learning how to solve complex problems and say, how do you take a problem, you break it down into all its component pieces, and then you figure out an elegant solution to it. That was really what I got good at. And so as I started to think about, everybody at Stanford talks about entrepreneurship. I was decidedly not an entrepreneur. I don't like failure. I don't like, you know, I mean, I guess I do like risk, but at the time I was thinking, I don't like risk. I just want something steady, you know, like my parents, you know, just kind of go to work and do your job. But eventually the bug kind of bit me and I said, man, you know, I wonder if I can take this ability to like solve these problems and look at an industry and be like, what's the problem and how can I solve it? How can I come up with a creative solution to solve it? And so I ended up doing that and looking for a company to run. And I was super excited. I was super passionate about pets. So I had I had two dogs.
I was going to say, what's
love
the
dogs.
Attachment.
Yeah. Like I volunteered at the Humane Society, like that kind of stuff, you know? And so I started looking at the pet industry and everything was being done well. People love their pets. There's a lot of money being invested in it, right?
And so we spent a fortune on animals.
Yeah, there's, I mean, veterinary care, it's state of the art. You know, you go into some of these vet clinics and it looks like Mayo. And so, I'm like, I'm not making that better. There's not a problem there. The problem is the price, but, you know, I don't know why it's expensive. So I'm not going to try to solve that problem. And I looked at end of life care for pets. Like, what happens when a pet dies? Well, back in 2013, what happened when a pet dies was someone with a rusted out pickup truck and a ratty t-shirt comes up and puts your pet in a trash bag and throws them into the back of a pickup truck. Like that's what was happening.
Or you bury it in your backyard.
Or you bury it in your backyard. Yeah. And so I said, how can we make end of life care, like pet cremation, effectively better? How do we make the worst day for a pet parent a little easier? Because it's a bad day.
Yeah.
You know, I say sometimes it's harder to lose a pet than to lose a human family member.
Sometimes that is your family member.
Sometimes it is your family member. And so like, why are we not treating them with dignity and respect in life and death? And so we ended up building a business out of that, 120 employees, you know, seven locations.
I was going to say Dallas, Miami, Houston, Austin. You listed a bunch of cities. And you started based out of Dallas in pet cremation. I would say making a terrible moment a little bit better. And not having that crusty, seedy guy show up with a trash bag and throw it in the back of a pickup truck.
Can you imagine? You just spent $10,000 in oncology treatment on your French bulldog, and then some guy treats him like trash. It's like, it's not right.
We had an English bulldog that died out of nowhere from a heat stroke, and a French bulldog that was completely normal. Then the next day, it had a brain lesion in 24 hours. We drove to Gainesville, spent thousands of dollars, put the dog down on site. Yeah, I can relate to
this.
And
we did beautiful funerals and, you know, you name it.
So this, you got that entrepreneurial itch. Clearly grew and scaled a business, changed a market entirely. The addiction process, like when for you, it was predominantly alcohol. Yeah. When did that start?
So I would say that while I was in the Army, I started developing a relationship with alcohol. I didn't drink in high school. I didn't really drink. West Point, believe it or not, is not exactly a party school.
One of my best friends went there. When he came to Jacksonville, he'd get after it. Just saying.
Well, that's because he left the confines of West Point. Yeah,
that's true.
And so I didn't really develop much in college. In the Army, though, I think I started to get into a little bit more of that work hard, play hard culture.
Yep.
And it was just, it wasn't an unhealthy relationship. It was just a relationship, you know? And I think as I transitioned out of the Army, I didn't really know my place and there were a lot of questions. It's hard to transition out of the Army.
Oh, yeah.
For a lot of reasons. And so, you know, in trying to find that, I started to struggle with anxiety and depression a little bit. And I started to drink to take the edge off a hard day at work. And so now, instead of using alcohol as like, oh, it's this fun thing, I'm using it to mitigate negative emotions. Even if it's just like, I'm stressed out, I'm a little stressed out, I need a drink. And so I'm using alcohol as a tool to deal with negative emotions. And I learned that that could be that. And then as the negative emotions got bigger, as the challenges got larger with entrepreneurship, with some personal stuff, I started using that tool more and more,
mm-hmm.
right? So the tool works for a small thing, a little bit of the tool. As it gets bigger, now I need more of the tool. And so now I'm using more and more and more. And so it just ended up spiraling down. And, you know, unfortunately, the way addiction is, you know, if you have that gene or whatever it is, that spiral just keeps going for you. Whereas a lot of people can turn it around.
Was it just alcohol or did other things come into the mix?
Yeah. So I was using cocaine as well. Okay. Those were kind of my two. You know, thankfully, I never had access to opiates, you know, and, you know, we've seen what a toll that has taken on our society. And like, you know, I'm sure I would have had I had access to it. I just didn't have access to it. And so, primarily those two, I would say alcohol was my drug of choice. And I think largely because it enabled me to drink more, cocaine enabled me to drink more.
That's why cocaine was
like, you know, it kind of balanced me out a little bit. And so then I was getting more alcohol into my system, which, you know, even if you don't feel it at the time because of this counterbalancing thing, it still takes the same toll internally in your body.
Was this an everyday activity, a weekend warrior? Like, what was your, because I'm going to share a little bit about my experience recently.
So initially weekend warrior, and then slowly transitioned as it does, you know, it's like weekends go from, you know, it's Friday and Saturday night. And then it's like, oh, well, brunch on Sunday, you know, and it's like, well, maybe I can kick off on Thursday. And then on Monday, I'm not feeling too good. So maybe I have a couple of drinks on Monday. And so it kind of starts as one thing and then it just creeps out until you look at it and you're like, I'm having four doubles at lunch.
Yeah.
Like, what is happening?
What just happened?
You know?
Go ahead, Trey.
Did the drinking pick up as you became more successful?
Yes, but I think causation correlation.
Okay.
Like, I don't know enough. If it was like directly associated.
Chicken or
maybe
the egg.
Maybe the stress became bigger because you're dealing with more stuff, but sure. I think it was more so just happened to be that way.
Gotcha.
I'm going to try to give a really brief story here because we had communicated back and forth. He was scheduled to come on the show. We've met throughout Jacksonville, mutual connections. I went to an inpatient rehab. It's been 2 months, which is crazy to think. And very similar situation. I probably drank since I was 14 years old and it was on the weekends. And in college, we partied a lot, but from the outside looking in, I checked all the box, right? Oh my gosh, the parents look, the marriage looks great. The business looks great. The show, like I was drinking every single day and it wasn't waking up and drinking. I always say I wasn't a big liquor drinker, but right around 4 o'clock, like it's time.
Yeah.
And it was, I call it death by paper cuts. There was no, I had moments in life that were difficult, but there was a morning, it was a Monday. I was like, what? I just hit a wall. I was like, I need to figure something out. I didn't know anything about recovery. I didn't know anything about inpatient versus outpatient. And for me, God bless my wife, parents, and close friends. I was like, I need to do something now. So I packed up. I like, I'll give Futures a plug. I still have my notebook, but I mean, this is 2 months ago. I text you. I think you were scheduled to be on the show that week.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, this is why I had to reschedule. And immediately,
I mean, we were golfing with you that day.
I golfed with these two right here.
Yeah.
And they had no idea. I left that golf tournament, what would probably appear normal. And I was checked into inpatient rehab 2 days later. And you, by the way, thank you for your help.
Like, yeah, my pleasure. I mean, it's like, it's incredibly brave for you to talk about this. You know, I mean, it's, I know I'm talking about my recovery journey, but I think the proximity of this event, I think it gives a lot of hope to other people. And it, you know, it tells people that look, this is something that does happen. It's not great, but it does happen. And if it's happening to you, like, okay, it's okay to do something about it. And like, here you are today, you know, in a totally different person. And so it's amazing how, you know, we can stay stuck in this for so long, or we can do something and then we get back on track. You know,
you look, there's other people too, where I went, there's all different levels, like spectrum. This can hit anyone. I had a 72-year-old roommate at one point. I had a 30-year-old roommate at one point. You have grandmothers, mothers, successful entrepreneurs, CEOs, like literally every spectrum, police officers, nurses. some cocaine. Have you heard of kratom, by the way?
Oh,
kratom?
I just did an article on kratom. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that stuff's a lot of people there for that.
Explain.
You can buy it over the counter. It works on your brain similar to an opioid.
Yeah, they just Florida just made 7-OH illegal, which is a derivative of kratom that was being sold in gas stations. So it was basically take the most potent part of kratom, strip it out, concentrate it, and put it in a pill, which ends up being 23 times more powerful than morphine, and you sell it at the gas station.
It's
insane. They just made it illegal, thank God. But it's going to continue. Kratom's going to continue to be a problem.
You said something though. I look at this, you or anyone, as an opportunity to be an example for other people. And it's not like, who am I to give advice, to tell people what to do, but it's sharing our journey or perspective. And it may, if it relates to one person, I think that's beneficial.
In the rooms, we talk about sharing your experience, strength, and hope.
Yeah.
So what happened, or what was life like? What happened and what's life like now?
Yep.
And that simple story, like that format, resonates with so many people because it's so easy for us when we're stuck in active addiction to be like, you have no idea what I'm going through. And you don't, you do. But not everyone
sorry,
does,
guys.
Right? No. Yeah. But not everyone does, right? And so it's not that we should dismiss other people that are trying to help us, but it's very easy for us to do so. When we look at someone who's been through the same stuff and can go toe to toe with our stories and all the stupid stuff we've done, we start seeing bits of ourselves in them. And then we see where they are now. And we're like, oh, I want what he has.
There's a lot of self-deprecation I've noticed, right? I like to poke fun and make fun as to the people that I was residents with. I made incredible friends. You get very close, very fast because there's no guard. There's no mask. It's like, but the other thing too, I'd love your perspective. Like the person in the mirror, the man in the mirror, no one else is coming. Like until you're ready and you acknowledge, like I need to work on this. No one's doing anything. You can have all the lessons and all of it, but until you say, like, all right, I'm ready. Would you agree or add anything to that?
Yeah. So the only caveat I'll say is you don't necessarily have to be ready on day one.
Oh.
So we have people that come into our facility that are clearly not ready. They're there because their wife gave them an ultimatum. They're there because they got in trouble at work. They're there because the judge said so. And so they're not coming in for the quote right reasons. And if you stay in that mode, you're not going to be successful long term. However, some people, once they start doing the work and they start doing a little more introspection, they get to that point. So sometimes people say, oh, well, you can't help somebody until they're ready to get helped. And it's like, true in a way. However, sometimes you can help them take those first few steps, and then that helps them get ready, if that makes sense.
Again, you guys are sitting in, we're talking about addiction and rehab here, but
I mean, I'm a drinker. I can see how I could easily go down the rabbit hole. Like, I love this.
There were a couple things that really stood out for my time there. One of them is recognizing the spectrum from use to abuse to addiction, right? So I'm not saying... like you using booze or whatever it is, say it's weed or kratom or any, I mean, some of the stuff I think is bad. If you're using opioids recreationally, probably not healthy.
Do people really check in for weed?
I know that's now all the time.
Really?
Yeah. All the time. Yeah. More and more we're seeing it. I would say, I mean, we get several admissions a month from THC. You know, I don't think this is like necessarily they, you know, have a plant in their backyard and they like harvest the leaves and smoke it. Those guys are probably fine, but you start buying some of the stuff from the smoke shop. And I think especially
for people
with underlying mental health conditions. So if you have some underlying mental health conditions, depending on what they are, weed can certainly exacerbate it. Like psychosis is one, like marijuana induced psychosis we see all the time. And so that's becoming more and more.
You go back. And again, it's you using weed, marijuana, whatever term you want. No one's coming to you and saying like, hey, you might have a problem. You know what abuse is. Like in college, we abused booze. And then addiction, again, to me, like every day around 4 o'clock, I'm like, oh man, I need a tall boy from the gas station.
Mm-hmm.
So, but another thing you talked about, until someone's ready. So at Futures Recovery, where I was, you'd have 40 to 50 people at any given time. Only four of us were self-admitted. The rest of them were an intervention from their family, court-ordered, or job ordered. Like, I mean, so for someone to admit themselves, I'm not saying it's rare, but a huge percentage, go back to what you said.
It's really hard, right? For whatever reason, when we're stuck in it, it's very hard to see. And I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know if it's because we don't see a way out or because we don't think we have a problem. I think there's a mix of reasons why it's hard to see for us, but sometimes we need that prodding from friends and family. And so, you know, if you're listening to this and you're like, my husband, my wife, my kid, my mom, my dad is struggling, you know, don't believe the myth that there's nothing you can do, because there is stuff you can do. You know, there is.
Again, I laugh. I keep forgetting you two guys were there on this. Like, there wasn't one given moment. It was a wonderful day. We golfed. We had a blast. And then I drove home and had like a full-on break, which I shouldn't have drove. That was another thing. I was drinking and driving. I'm 42 years old.
Yeah.
Goodness gracious.
We got kids. Oof.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm embarrassed. That's the thing, too. Like, what are you embarrassed of? That's probably the biggest one. At one point in my life, when I was a firefighter, I would never imagine drinking and driving. And then like that little paper cut just comes and I catch myself driving home. I was like, I got to figure this out.
Yeah. And so many people like underestimate what that line is, you know, especially if you're stuck in addiction. You know, we have people come in all the time, and I'm sure I did too. I just didn't do a breathalyzer, but we have people that come in at 9 a.m. and they blow 0.24 and you're like, I haven't had anything to drink today. I'm fine. And
How much did you have yesterday?
Yeah. How much did you have yesterday? And so we underestimate how often, I think, when we are caught in this use cycle, like how often we're putting ourselves and others at risk.
So back to Sophros, was this after your experience in recovery, you're like, I'm passionate about this, or I see a gap in the market?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a true entrepreneur now.
Yeah. You got the itch. I've got it.
Yeah. I'm a true entrepreneur now. I mean, I remember sitting in rehab on probably day 10. I'm sober now. I'm an expert. And so,
hey,
so I'm like, what business can I build? I work on this thing, you know, late into the night, and I come in and I want to use my one-on-one therapy session the next day with my psychologist to talk about gaps in the market and how I can address them through a business opportunity. And he's like, maybe you should just focus on being sober for now. I'm like, yeah, but see, there's a hole in sober living homes, and like the way sober living homes are designed now, I feel like we could change them. And he's like, mm-mm. We're not doing this. I said, okay, fair enough.
Back in.
Yeah,
that's the thing too about entrepreneur. When you get the itch, good luck turning it off. But I can relate to that at Futures. By day 8, I'm like, oh man, there's a business opportunity here. What used to be called halfway houses. This is one too. You know all the houses on A1A between Pontevedra and St. Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
Like so. You could buy a couple of those houses that have really high end sober living situations.
There's plenty. I mean, look, there's so many of us that struggle, and there aren't solutions for everyone. And I think so much of the future of treatment is like, how do we start to make solutions that work for various groups of people and, you know, in different ways? Yep. I think it's important.
We got about 2 minutes left. We love shout outs. Anyone, you'd mentioned your fiance earlier, anyone else like, oh, what's up? You never know who's listening.
Yeah. I mean, Victoria, she's been one of my biggest supporters. You know, at one point during our relationship, I struggled with relapse. And so, you know, she was there for me and like, helped me get it together. And I was telling you before the show, I mean, we go on dates to, you know, dinner and a meeting. And it's like so absurd, but it's like part of our ritual and we love it, you know, and we go to the same places. And, you know, it just helps me stay sober being in a healthy relationship.
That's good. So. Any business partners, people, your staff?
Obviously. Yeah, I mean, our whole team's amazing. I mean, they really make Sophros what it is. Erin is my partner in the business, and I'm not a clinician, right? So as much as I like to think I know this stuff, I'm not a clinician, and she's, you know, world-class clinician that just has really built the program into what it is today.
Hi, Mom. Love you. Got to say that to the mom every time. Yeah, we got a whole second half. Time always flies by. Nick Padlow, Sophros Recovery. That's what the hell just happened! Welcome back to the second half of What the Health Just Happened. If you're here on the radio station, you missed the first half. Good news is you can catch the full episode on your favorite podcast or YouTube under What the Health Just Happened. We talked a lot about recovery. We're going to addiction specifically. When we say recovery, we're not talking about a blown out knee here. Sophros Recovery, that's outpatient recovery treatment following whether you go to inpatient or not. Nick Padlow, CEO, entrepreneur. You're pretty cool, man. I'm just going to say that. The first time we got to hang out here. Great conversation. We'll probably hit some more in the second half or lots, but I like healthy or not healthy.
Okay. You ready? Let's do it.
Healthy or not healthy, selling ice cream at the Jag Stadium.
Healthy.
That was his first job here in Jackson, which I love. Healthy or not healthy, the animal cremation industry.
Healthy now.
Healthy or not healthy, throwing your hats in the air when you graduate at West Point.
Healthy.
This is, by the way, I still have this when my best friend graduated. Do you recognize that?
That's great.
I've had that in my house for 20 years.
Oh my gosh.
It's pretty beat up.
What year was he?
He was 2004.
Oh, a year after me.
Or 2000. what would 2005? We graduated 01, that'd make him 2005. Shout out Chris Allen, by the way.
That's great.
But I haven't taken that out of the closet in a long time.
Yeah, my nephew has mine. They let kids run onto the field when you throw it. And so my nephew, I didn't throw mine, I faked it and then gave it to my nephew.
So at the end at West Point, they throw their hats, and it's actually a pretty cool sight to see when they, would you call it graduation?
Yeah, graduation.
Or moving on from institutionalization, would you call it?
A little of both.
But after graduation, all these kids had hats and I had $40 cash. I was like, I really want to buy. So some kids walking by, I offered him $40. He goes, I have 10 of these. I come every year. He took the $40. It made me think of you.
And he actually made more money because we always put cash in here for the kids too. So
he took that out of there.
He got a little extra.
Yeah. I thought you might appreciate that. Healthy or not healthy, seeking treatment.
Healthy.
Let's dive in. What is treatment? We talk about that. Depending what you're looking at, what's your perspective? What is treatment? That's a pretty broad question there.
Yeah, it's funny because no one really knows if they haven't been through it. You know, people say, they see it on TV. My knowledge before I went to rehab was when a celebrity went to rehab or when an actor in a movie went to rehab. That was all I knew. And even then, I didn't really know what it was about. And so my perspective is that we go into rehab for a couple of reasons, or we go into treatment for a couple of reasons. One is to get a little distance between us and our drug of choice. Let our brain start readapting. Just the not using is healthy. And then the second thing is we start to share these stories that you mentioned in rooms where other people have similar experiences. And so sharing the story is healthy. Hearing other people's stories is healthy. And then third, what we're trying to do is really get to the root of what led us down this road in the first place. Most of the time, addiction is a symptom, not a cause. And so it's like, I'm dealing with depression, I'm dealing with anxiety, it's popping up in the form of addiction. And now that's its own problem. I'm not to say that if you get rid of the addiction, the depression, anxiety, now I can go back to drinking. I can't personally. I know that. I've tried. It doesn't work for me. I have done the market research.
Yeah, that's right.
Unsuccessfully.
I got receipts.
Yeah. And so then the last piece is picking up tools and skills. You know, when we were in the Army, we learned, you know, all these different battle drills. The most common is a battle drill 1 alpha. So when you're taking enemy fire, 3 people lay down suppressive fire. So they start firing back. 2 people move to the right. They move up and then they give a signal and they move across the objective. If someone were to start firing at me now on the street, my brain would initially go to battle drill 1. I don't have a squad, so it wouldn't be helpful.
We got you. Well, yeah,
you
hold on.
Yeah, you guys got hold it. On, yeah, I have the hand and arm signals.
We'd be looking at you, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Go that way.
But my brain immediately goes to that. And so we have to pick up tools and skills so that when life throws life at us, when life gets lifey in whatever form it might be, job stress, relationship, you know, cravings, whatever pops up.
Children.
No, seriously, children, yeah, right? 100%. It was this whole mommy wine time thing, right? It's a thing. And so when that stuff happens, do I have a tool for that? Do I have a skill, a battle drill that's so deeply ingrained in my brain that now I take a different path? And it takes some time and it takes a lot of work.
Well, that was, I would say, a good version. I'm going to have to go back and listen to that. So I heard essentially 4 stages, right? Is elimination or taking yourself out of a situation was the first one. Mm-hmm. What was the second one?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I love it. I immediately was like, there's no way.
I was winging it. I know.
He's not going to recall any of this. So the one at the end, though, is tools to put in place. Mm-hmm. That's part of treatment. And we say, what does it take to stay sober?
Yeah.
That's the tools.
Yeah.
What tools do you find valuable?
So one of the most common tools that we see in therapy is called cognitive behavioral therapy. And so the easiest way to understand this is when our brain starts to tell us something that's like mildly untrue, like, I'm not a good father. No one's ever going to love me. I'm not good enough. Like these lies that our brain tells us, these mantras, how do I take that statement? How do I take this? I need a drink today. Okay. Let me understand that thought. Let me test it using a system and then figure out what the thought actually is. Go ahead.
No, this might take us on a tangent, but what about the guy that isn't maybe depressed, but just likes feeling drunk? Like, how
it's
do you go?
It's less common than what you would think.
Really?
I would say 5% maximum.
Okay. Sorry, I just...
There's normally something going on. Okay. Like, even just the correlation between what we call adverse childhood events. So there's a test, ACEs score. So, like, you know, was I neglected as a kid? Were either my parents alcoholics? Was I in an abusive home? Was I in a divorced home? All these things. Even just that, there's a higher correlation between your ACEs score and addiction than there is with childhood obesity and diabetes.
Where can you take an ACEs score?
Anywhere online. There's just like nine questions. I've never heard of it. Yeah, there's nine questions.
Well, how do you spell it?
ACE. I don't...
ACE test.
Yeah, adverse childhood experience is... I don't know why we put the S on the end.
But. Again, I love learning new stuff. ACE. Yeah. Adverse childhood experience, which I'm sure we all have.
Yeah. So cognitive behavioral therapy is the number one. How do I reframe unhealthy thoughts into healthy ones? The next one, which we talked about before, is dialectical behavior therapy. DBT. And I like to say this is... Yeah, DBT is kind of when the temperature is too hot that I can't reframe my thoughts. I'm pissed, I'm sad, I'm depressed, I'm having massive cravings. If you tell me to reframe my thoughts, I'm going to tell you what you can do.
Go pound sand.
Exactly. Exactly. And so you have this I need to turn the fire extinguisher is what I call it, right? I need to just accept that I feel like I need a drink right now. I'm not going to try to reframe it. I feel like that. And I'm going to make a different decision. So the dialectic is two seemingly opposite things that can be true at the same time. So it involves a little more acceptance of our thoughts than CBT, where CBT is saying, hey, this thought is not accurate. Let me reframe it. DBT is saying, hey, that thought is what it is. And we have something else.
So again, I keep talking about futures recovery. That was my adult sleepaway camp that I call it, AKA inpatient rehab. It was a lot of their core principles were based off of DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. And it is that two opposing things can be true at the same time, which is weird. And there's a way more complicated way to dive into it. If you have not seen, Nick Padlow did a TEDx talk. Just go on to YouTube or Google, type in Nick Padlow TEDx. It's about recovering addiction, but the tools, the recovery toolkit. And I'm stealing this from you. I don't know if you remember saying this.
Yeah.
I don't remember saying it.
I rehearsed that one a lot. So
CBT is a wrench. Right? That's a tool.
Making
tool
adjustments,
set.
Yeah.
DBT, if your house is on fire, you're not going to use a wrench to put the fire out. You need a fire extinguisher to put it out. So what are the other tools? I don't know if you remember those.
So one of the big ones is some type of either 12-step or other recovery program. So we do smart recovery at Sophros. We also do a monthly AA speaker meeting, which is 12-step. I work in AA program, and I also go to smart meetings. And so what that does is it gives us a long-term safe community with other tools kind of embedded inside it to help keep us sober. I speak to my sponsor twice a week. So it doesn't mean I won't relapse. I could certainly relapse. And at some point he's going to notice.
Mm.
Right. And so it's just a guardrail. I mean, it does other things for me as well, but it also serves as a guardrail that keeps me honest. I know I've got to go back and talk to him. And again, I could fake it for a while, I'm sure.
How often does that happen, you think, in recovery?
That people go off the rails?
Or they fake it with their sponsor?
A lot. I mean, a lot, right? We don't, you know, we talk about working a program of honesty, which is a lot easier to do when we're not using. When we're relapsing, it's a little harder to work a program of honesty, you know? I give people a little caveat. It doesn't mean that you're not an honest person if you lie about your use. It means you're not being honest right now. And it happens a lot because our use, that part of our brain that wants to use, doesn't want to be exposed either. There's shame and there's guilt. And then I face that. And then I got to do all these other things. And like, it's not that bad. I can fix it on my own. You start to hear all these voices that, you know, tell you that for whatever reason, you shouldn't talk about it. So it definitely happens. But it also happens where people do talk about it. And, you know, I have all the respect in the world for those people.
We have Trey and Danny sitting in here. One of you asked about the coin. I think Trey asked about the coin.
Oh, yeah, the coin.
Do you, and Danny was not familiar, like, what's the significance of a coin? For anyone, this is a very particular audience, right? Whether you've gone through recovery, you're thinking about it, maybe you have family members that hear this, but what's the significance of a coin? How do you earn them? Why are they important to you?
So for a lot of us in addiction, we couldn't go a day without our drug of choice if we're honest with ourselves. You know, it doesn't mean we got drunk every day or, you know, went through a gram of drugs in a day, but we were ingesting something most days. And if we weren't, we definitely were every week.
Yeah.
And we certainly weren't doing dry January. Or if we did, it was like impossible. You know, people talked about dry January when I was in active addiction. I'm like, why would you do that?
Sober October.
What in the world, you know? And maybe we can do that, but it's hard. And so what we do in the rooms is we recognize, and at Sophros, is we recognize lengths of sobriety. You know, hey, I got 24 hours sober, which for some people they haven't done in 10 years. I got 30 days sober. I got 60 days sober. I got 90 days sober. And so it serves as a couple things. One, it's recognition. It's celebration of what you're doing. Because nobody else outside our rooms is going to give you a pat on the back for not using methamphetamines for 90 days. Congratulations. Good job. Yeah, good job. Well, as addicts and alcoholics, we know how big of a deal that is. And we know how impossible that is. My natural state, if I do nothing, my natural state is to be drunk and high somewhere. That's where I would go. And so I have to do things in my life in order not to be there. And so that work, we recognize that, you know, in our rooms, and we give people credit, and it also inspires the newcomer. You know, they see me get a year of sobriety and they hear my story, we always yell, how'd you do it, when somebody gets a year or more. And so then they talk about it and you're like, wow, like I want to be like that guy. And that inspires them. So there's a lot of reasons why we do it. And also, I don't want to start back at one. I've had to start back at one, and it sucks. It sucks to walk up to the front of that room and get that white chip and have to start over. No one shames you. No, everyone's glad you're back, and I don't want to do it again.
Do you golf?
Not well. Not often. I used to golf more than I golf now, but
I enjoy, they're great ball markers. That's what I say.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Oh, that's a great idea.
Those chips are great ball markers.
Now I want to go golf again.
I will admit, when I golfed, there was a lot of beers going down on that golf course, which I've, again, trying to do things that I used to do. And like, when did I need alcohol for everything? I don't know when it happened, but it did. Okay. So back to, what does it take to stay sober? What are your tools? How do you stay busy? How do you, you know, you'd mentioned meetings, smart recovery. That's different than AA. I know this stuff, but some people may not know the difference.
Yeah. So for me, what I do is I go to Monday, Thursday, Saturday, 3 to 4 meetings a week is what I do now. That's one smart meeting and 2 to 3 AA meetings a week. Those meetings kind of have different formats. Sometimes they're big book studies. Sometimes it's just a normal open meeting. Smart recovery is a little different, just a little different format. We do crosstalk. So in AA, one person stands up and they sit down. Next person stands up and they sit down. It's in order to kind of keep order in the room. Smart's more like a process group where you're kind of ping ponging off each other. Hey, when I went through that, and you're giving feedback to other people. It's a little more like a group therapy session. There's pros and cons to both. There's no sponsors in SMART, which I think is a drawback, but every program has its pros and cons. So
have you heard of Dharma?
Dharma's great. We have a Dharma recovery meeting at Sophros as well on Wednesdays.
So that's good. Let's talk about Sophros. Who needs to know about, you have in person in Tampa and Jacksonville, and then virtual. Yep. Also Spanish speaking. I think that's a big deal. We talked about that too. So who needs to know about your program that may not know about it?
I mean, you know, I think anyone who is struggling, it's good to know that there's an option out there that's, you know, our heart's in the right place and we have the therapist that can deliver programming at a you know, excellent level. I think family members to know that something like that exists, you know, because we think about rehab. I mentioned most people just know rehab. It's like, oh, I can't go away for 30 days. Yep. I can't do that. And I could debate whether or not you can or can't.
Sure,
you probably can. You also can't afford to continue staying in your addiction. So, you know, there's trade-offs here. But if someone's in that place, it's like, okay, well, here's the option. Okay, well, you go in there 3 hours a day. Oh, I can't. I've got work. Okay, we offer it at night.
Options. That's a great, without sharing names. I'm trying to share my story and experience. Anyone who's interested, I'm happy to talk about it. But since my experience, people who know have been reaching out, close friends, some family members that are clearly going through some issues, and I won't say names on this, but I had to explain to him the difference between inpatient and outpatient. I think it's the fact that you have options.
Exactly. You start to take away some of those excuses, right? Yeah. I can't do this because of this. Okay, well, how about this? Can you do this? You know, and again, we can eliminate some of those excuses later. You know, it's like, well, I can't, I have my kids. And it's like, well, would you rather your kids miss you for 30 days and then have a father that shows up for the rest of their lives? Or would you rather be around for the next 30 days? Like, we can figure out the next 30 days, but let's get you well.
I'm not trying to make this about me. It's just all of this is fresh in mind. But that was it on that Monday. And I had, for months, I knew, I was like, I got to figure something out. I was so fortunate. The circle I have, I'm not coming back to an unsafe environment. My parents and wife are so supportive. It's like, everyone's like, go. Just get off the grid. You have no cell phone the first 10 days, which was amazing. But I was lucky to have it. And then while I'm in there, I'm learning these other resources available. But it, like, for me personally, I knew, I'm like, I got to figure something out and do it. And until someone recognizes that or they're court ordered, they may avoid it. So I'm just saying what you're doing, that is an option.
And I just wanted to mention, you know, since you mentioned how supportive your friends and family were, you know, unfortunately not everyone's in that. I was in that boat as well. I had supportive friends and family. Not everyone's in that boat. You know, some people are with a partner who is also in active addiction. Some people are with parents or kids that are not supportive of their recovery, who make things harder. And unfortunately, we can't control other people, right? All we can do is do our own work. And then we have to figure out our next steps and what is healthiest for us. But unfortunately, if you are in that situation, the work is harder and you have to do more.
Yep.
It's still doable, though.
I used to ask this question on every episode. I think I'm bringing these back. So if you met yourself 1, 3, 5, 10, 20 years ago, what's some healthy advice you would give yourself?
Oh, man. So, I mean, I think 10 years ago, let's see, what would that have been? That would have been 15. So I was just starting to get, into active addiction. And I think it would have been, you know, start to get into therapy and address the things that you need to in life. You know, maybe when I was coming out of rehab, maybe the message would be like, be kind to yourself, because this is all going to be part of your story one day. It's hard to see in the moment that it's going to be part of your story, but you know, thank God I became an alcoholic and then got better. It was the hardest thing that ever happened to me.
That's a good perspective.
But man, like, I'm doing what I love now, and I'm the person I am and working on myself because of that experience. And so it's okay. And it's going to be okay.
Are you using your own product? That sound really weird to ask it like that. Like, Safra, do you engage in classes in the course or not? Now you're running the business.
Not direct. I mean, I go to Smart on Saturdays. Most weeks. And so I do go to that like kind of free offering that we have. I used to lead it. Now I don't lead it. Now I'm just another person, which is great. You know, and I try to, I use my therapist, you know, thankfully I work with 10, 12 therapists. No, they're not my therapists, right? That's not their job. And they also give great advice sometimes when you're struggling with something. So we have a wonderfully open and honest work environment, I think, where people feel confident to talk about things that they're struggling with and work through them at work, which is great. Yeah. Also seems very time consuming at times. But man, is it worth it? So if somebody's struggling with something, they talk about it and they get good advice from, you know,
that's
professionals,
that's
even
healthy.
If they're not in the capacity.
Yeah, healthy environment.
Definitely healthy.
Okay. So you look out 1, 3, 5, 10, 20 years, what's a healthy change that you'd like to see in this industry? I didn't prep you for these. A lot of times I'll say like, hey, think about this ahead of time.
No, it's tough. I mean, I think that one of the biggest challenges is this inequity of care. We live in a system that is two-tiered right now. Unfortunately, it's there are options for the haves and there are options for the have-nots. And so people with money to private pay or people with commercial health insurance have access to more treatment. And frankly,
that's just a fact.
They have access to Sophros.
Yep.
Right. And so we do scholarships when we can. We accept all the exchange plans now. We're trying to do what we can to kind of push into that market so that we can serve more people that need help that aren't necessarily, you know, don't necessarily have insurance or money to pay for a program. So we do whatever we can to help. And it still remains hard. And not every treatment center is going to do that like we do and give scholarships and stuff like that. And so it is hard, and I don't know the solution. I know the exchange is struggling. I know Medicaid is about to take a big hit. And so there's an answer out there. And as I think, just without getting too nerdy about it, you know, money invested into behavioral health pays itself back into the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. So if you have diabetes and you have alcohol use disorder, like the cost of treating your diabetes is going to be 3 times larger or whatever. I made up that number, but it's something astronomically
high. Sounds good
to
me.
It's a lot more, right? More than the cost of your alcohol treatment. So the healthcare system as a whole, if they're thinking at a macro level, can figure out how to address this in a way that gets everyone the help they need and isn't a cost center for the healthcare system, because it's not.
Man, I got to be careful. We open this can. I still think at the end of the day, what makes healthcare organizations more money? I hate to say it, like, we work in employee benefits. It's health insurance. What's it like working with insurance companies? Is that the bane of your existence, or do you have a good experience?
All my partners are wonderful.
They're okay.
I'm glad you asked. It's challenging. It's challenging, and I outsource a lot of that because it is very frustrating to me. So I do work with a billing company that handles most of that because it is very frustrating, right? It's frustrating to do the work and have them want to cut off client care for whatever reason. You know, they say, oh, this client's not appropriate for care. And it's like, what do you mean this client? Like, yes, they are. And then they say no. And I'm like, fine, scholarship them for the rest of their treatment, you know? And so thankfully we're able to do that. We're not able to do it an infinite number of times, but we can do it when we can to try to help. But the system is not great.
That's a 48-minute conversation that we're going to have to table to the next time you come back.
Episode two.
You had talked about getting more involved with nonprofits. You personally. So what does that look like? Other organizations you'd mentioned were Fresh. We talked about Here Tomorrow. Shout out for them. Local nonprofits, organizations, you're like, I really am trying to get involved with this because...
So I recently took part in the LSF Zero Suicide Summit, which was awesome. Brought together leaders from all over the city and the state to talk about how we reduce suicide in Jacksonville. And I gave a keynote speech there, which was awesome. I love that organization and what they do. Here Tomorrow, we just sponsored their event 2 weeks ago. It kind of got rained out, unfortunately, halfway through.
Florida.
But they're doing wonderful things to like help people who are struggling with suicidal ideation and hopelessness. You know, anytime that we can find an organization that's doing work in the space, we say, you know, how can we support them? And of course, like if they see someone that's struggling, they can send them to us too. But at the end of the day, it's about how do we become a better community partner so that we're helping, you know, address the addiction and mental health in Northeast Florida.
They say a rising tide lifts all ships. There's just so, again, this is, we're talking just about Jacksonville. You also have a location in Tampa. You do stuff remote. There's so many things in Northeast Florida that we don't even know about. It's Here Tomorrow. I mentioned they're coming on in 2 weeks to do an episode also. That's excited.
Yeah, you're going to enjoy that.
Couple minutes here left. What's on the horizon? What are you looking forward to? What are some things that are working? Like you're like, oh, this, we're firing in all cylinders here.
I mean, I'll answer the former more than the latter, what we're working on, because I can tell I love what we're doing. I think we're doing great in a lot of ways. You know, I think we could get involved more in kind of the fringes. There's a book called Profit from the Core by a guy named Michael Zook, and it talks about find the one thing you do better than anyone in the world and do that thing. And then when you get a bright idea to do something else, go back to your core and do more of that thing. And so while trying to focus on that, his second book is about what are the adjacencies? What are the things just outside the fringes of what you do now that you could do better, right? How do we do better veteran specific treatment? How do we do better outpatient treatment to lengthen this continuum of care where we can kind of, you know, maintain service to a client for a longer period of time? Because what we see is the most highly correlated statistic between success and recovery is number of days in treatment. So how do we start to give them support for longer? Even if it's at a lower level of support, that's fine. So what are the things that we can do on the fringes to help provide more services for the people of Jacksonville in Tampa?
I love a book recommendation. Profit from the Core?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, I'm almost done with the book I'm in, so that's good to know.
Yeah, if you like this one, you'll like that one.
Yeah, there's so many books in here, it's hysterical. My least favorite part is when we run out of time, so... I like this. I always go to LinkedIn and look at it. You have, I pulled the TEDx speaker. Great TEDx talk. We got to get you back, at least here in Jacksonville too. Entrepreneur, founder and CEO of Sophros Recovery, but guy in recovery.
Yeah.
Like you're putting that out there. This is who I am. And there's a lot of people, men and women, going through the same thing. So,
you know, when we're in active addiction, we always say we're an egomaniac with an inferiority complex.
And so
in some ways we carry around this huge ego and we, you know, think the world of ourselves, but deep down we have this inferiority complex. And my goal is just to become less of both of those things, right? Where I take off some of the ego, which I can tend to drift back into. And I also take off that self-hatred and that self-loathing. And so I just become more level. And like the reality is I'm just a guy in recovery, and however I can be helpful to people, man, that's my goal.
Healthy. Nick Padlow, Sophros Recovery. That's what the hell just happened.